Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Recruiting Podcast. It is the most wonderful time of the year. I am Terry Foy, joined by Dan Avern. And Dan, we're about a week into the annual Inside Lacrosse Recruiting issue. Having been dropped, what are your initial reactions?
I'm really just kind of excited to have it out there. I mean, it's something I've been working on all year, pretty much. You know, the last 3 months in particular, we've really been hitting the recruiting trail, staying adrift of that beat, and I'm really excited to have it out there. But, you know, today I think we are talking about recruiting classes for the most part and kind of delving into which ones we think are the most strong and which ones will be the most impactful. And this is where I'm going to kick it to you, Terry, because our number one recruiting class revealed in the recruiting issue is Notre Dame. And you actually took a really interesting approach and kind of analyzed not only what this class means impact-wise, but also how it was constructed and how it kind of reflects a change in the recruiting kind of agenda for Notre Dame.
Yeah, so, you know, first thing, I want to commend you and G. Shan for a really nice podcast last week. You guys unveiled that Tohoka Nanacook was the number one recruit in the 2017 class. And I think that following up by talking about the number one class in the 2017 class, that being the future Fighting Irish, is really appropriate because we had two covers for this issue of the magazine. One featuring Mr. Nanacook, the other featuring our number one defenseman, Arden Cohen, and Connor Morin, a top 10 recruit, an attackman who is kind of unlike anybody that's ever headed to South Bend in terms of his ability to play quarterback with size all the way around the board. And, you know, when thinking about the idea of Notre Dame having the number one class, kind of came to this realization that this is probably the most consistent program that has never attained this honor before. And when you go back through the last 14 years, which I did in this process, you know, there are some familiar names that aren't that surprising in terms of North Carolina, Johns Hopkins. Duke was our number one class last year. These are programs that have won national championships, and to attain that level of recruiting success is not shocking. That being said, you know, Notre Dame with its many appearances in the Final Four, I believe it's seven appearances in the Final Four, five Final Four appearances, to not have ever attained the number one recruiting class, I thought was kind of remarkable. But there was more to the story than that. Notre Dame has evolved as the recruiting landscape has evolved in a way that I think is really unique. You know, and so in telling this story, I went all the way back to 2002 when they were coming off of their initial Final Four run, in which they, you know, Kevin Corrigan's team did that without the benefit of any scholarships. And at that point in the program's historical arc, there was a belief that they were never going to have any scholarships. Maybe as a result of the popularity of that run, they realized that if we resourced up this program, it would be beneficial for the athletic department overall. And, you know, not being privy to the political conversation surrounding that, I mean, all I know is that they ended up implementing scholarships on a forward-looking basis, meaning that as players arrived, they were kind of on track to receive scholarships. And, you know, one of the first was a member of the class of 2006, so, you know, high school class of 2002, named Pat Walsh, a Wantok attackman, who ended up being a three-time All-American for the Fighting Irish, finished up with more than 200 points. And I think he kind of symbolized the turning of the page from, you know, the type of programs Notre Dame was able to recruit against. It was obviously offering a tremendous education and a high profile athletic department. But, you know, once scholarships were on the table, then money wasn't a reason that players weren't going to be a part of this program. And Coach Corrigan said, you know, pretty plainly, that was the goal. That was the motivation. We didn't want players to come because of the money. We just didn't want them to not come because they couldn't afford it or they couldn't figure out a way to compete financially with some of the other programs. And I think that over the course of the intervening five or so years, little by little, Notre Dame made gains in terms of competing with the highest end programs in college lacrosse on the recruiting front. You know, they probably outdistanced their recruiting success with their success on the field, meaning that they were, you know, winning games that the caliber of player that they were consistently bringing in suggested they shouldn't be, you know, a combination of their approach and system, as well as, you know, some of the other advantages that they had, including, you know, maybe how much better the players developed once they got on campus. All of that culminated into, you know, some of these really impressive early returns for the program. But then as you've seen this continue to evolve over the last 5 years, and I point to a couple of hallmarks for the program. So the first was transitioning from the GWLL, which was a lacrosse-specific league, and they were primarily competing with Ohio State and Denver in that league, transitioning to the Big East, where they were primarily competing with Syracuse. And then obviously in 2014, joining the ACC, when they went from, you know, competing exclusively with Syracuse in terms of their conference championship to now the, you know, continuing to rival the Orange, but also, you know, adding Virginia, North Carolina, and Duke, three of the programs that recruit at the highest level in this sport. You know, it all amounts to the fact that combining that with the way in which the university has supported the program materially, predominantly with Arlotta Stadium and everything that goes along with that, you know, scholarships, competition, stadium, there's very little that Notre Dame can't offer that everybody else in the country, all the best programs in the country do now. But it's more than that even. It's not just about a program builds its recruiting approach. It's also about how they utilize it. And I think that Notre Dame does two things that are unique. The first is they really position the overall experience that players have when they're on campus. And it's unfair to say that it's unique because it's not about the fact that they do it. It's about the manner in which they publicize what they offer to their student athletes. And whether it's through social media or email or their .com, they're very powerful in terms of the way in which they position their brand throughout the ecosystem of high school and club lacrosse. And I think that, you know, whether it's their local high school coaches clinics or some of the other things that they've done, not only does the program, you know, try to showcase the experience that the players receive annually, they also do a lot to try to service the coaches who can help be helpful conduits to the players that they want to recruit. So I think that's unique. And then obviously, over the last 3 years, as the practice of recruiting committed players has become more popularized and widespread, Notre Dame has been the face of that in many people's eyes, whether it's detractors, you know, people who say that this is something that the short sport shouldn't pursue, or, you know, folks who applaud Coach Corrigan and his staff for their candor in saying there's one moment in time that we respect with respect to a player's commitment, and it's when he signs his NLI either in November or February of his senior year of high school. And, you know, if he says he's not interested for whatever reason, including because he's committed somewhere else, then so be it. You know, we're not going to tell you that we're not interested in you, and if you change your mind, you can come back and talk to us. But aside from that, we're not going to be beholden to another program's verbal commitment that doesn't have any standing with the NCAA. And I think that, you know, that is what the story is about. However, it's even more than that. And this is the last point I'll make, and then I'll let you talk again. The thing about it is this is a moment in time that will never be replicated, because the recruiting rules changed in such a way that recruiting committed players is going to be a practice that one of two things happens. The first is more coaches are going to do it. So the fact that Notre Dame is unique for having done so, or unique for having been outwardly vocal about doing so, will no longer be a significant aspect or hallmark of their recruiting strategy relative to the rest of the landscape. And the second is, we don't know what's going to happen in the future with when players are going to commit. And so when they commit and when they can be poached, so to speak, is going to change. And it all amounts to this fact that this class of 2017 for Notre Dame, that is in double figures, tons of talent, it's a symbol for everything that the recruiting landscape has seen and experienced over the last 5 to 7 years. And I think that each individual player there within demonstrates that as well. It's not just about the fact that Adrian Enschel was originally a Notre Dame commit and ended up at Brown, or the fact that there are three players in this class who were originally committed elsewhere. Connor Morin, who I mentioned earlier, an attackman, was originally committed to Villanova Carson Cochran, a defenseman who was originally committed to Rutgers. And then there were players who were originally committed to Boston University and Fairfield as well. Four guys who were originally committed elsewhere are members of this Notre Dame class. There's also the function of post-grad years. So, you know, there were two guys that were originally in this class, Jake Moss and Jose Boyer, who are now members of the 2018 class. And then Mo Meyer was originally expected to take a PG year and decided that he wanted to go straight to South Bend and not take that post-grad year. So, so many dynamics at play within this that it just, it was too good of a story to not tell. All that being said, we still ought to talk about some of the guys in this class, right?
Yeah, yeah. This is a blockbuster class, I really do think, from front to back, with a lot of players who look to have very impactful trajectory for Notre Dame. Let's talk about the top of our list, number three overall, Arden Cohen. You've kind of written about him a lot. He's not what I think people think of when they think of the prototypical blockbuster defenseman. You know, a 6'4 guy, really rangy, covers a lot of ground, really mean. Arden Cohen, not the biggest guy, not the fastest guy, but definitely maybe one of the smartest guys, would you describe him as?
That, and I think he's so he's smart in the sense that he makes the right decisions, both in terms of when to support and when to stick on his man. He's also smart in terms of when he throws checks. So as a result, he doesn't find himself out of position very frequently in settled or unsettled situations. He's also smart in the sense of you see him lurk around a ground ball scrum. He knows when to pursue the ground balls so that he has the best chance of coming away from it. And I think that that combination of awareness is hugely important for any defenseman. And one of the other things that I like about his mentality is that he's a really gracious, unassuming kid when you're talking to him off the field, but he plays mean, you know, and it's kind of that lack of conscience that you want to see out of a defenseman. It's not that I don't care. It's not that I want to hurt you. It's that I don't care if I hurt you in the process of doing my job. If I throw a check and it hurts, so be it. And that is, to me, that's the line where you're playing physical, but you're not playing cheap or dirty. And I think that that's always what I've seen out of Cohen that's impressed me. He is strong. There's, you know, you can't be a number one player at your position without some exceptional physical attribute. And for me, it seems like it's his arm strength, his ability to handle the stick in a way that he can utilize it as a tool or a weapon without compromising his base. That is the starting point for how impressive he is as a physical athlete. But you're right. So much of why I think he's going to make a significant contribution for Notre Dame is between his ears.
Moving on to our number eight recruit is Connor Morin. You kind of mentioned him a little bit. Not exactly the type of offensive player that we've really seen at Notre Dame. You know, kind of a quarterback type who also has the shake and also has the size. When I think of Notre Dame, kind of like the marquee attackman that they brought in, the first guy at the top of the list is Matt Kavanaugh, who's kind of like a very ferocious wing dodger. And here we have Connor Morin, who's a guy who's probably going to operate from X and perhaps set up guys like Mikey Wynn and Ryder Garnsey.
It's interesting because when you say that about Matt Kavanaugh, I think about how he was at his best when complimented by Connor Doyle and how their righty-lefty two-man-behind situation was so difficult for opponents to handle. And I wonder if there's a way this season, if Connor Morin emerges as a starter, he can create that type of chemistry with Ryder Garnsey in a two-man-behind situation where he's attacking from the right side, Garnsey's attacking from the left side, and Mikey Wynn is attracting all the attention on the crease and keeping defenders honest as they're both moving. But one of the things that's important about that is not just the righty-lefty compliment, but it's also the big little compliment. The fact that, you know, you've got in Garnsey a really explosive shifty guy who's probably, in that a bit under 6 foot, you know, substantially under 200-pound frame, whereas Connor Morin is probably 6'3", 190, if I were going to guess. So they require different types of defensemen to match up against. You know, I think about it, for example, when they play Duke. Well, based on their body type, I think you're going to see Cade Van Raphorst match up against Connor Morin, and you're going to see John Thomas, Giles Harris match up against Mikey Wynn. The fact is, if you've got two guys who can start offense with the ball in their stick that can attack defensemen like that, and you feel okay about those matchups, I mean, that's a great starting point for any offense.
One thing that also impresses me about this class is how well-rounded it is. You actually have elite prospects at defense, LSM, attack, midfield. I believe they have a top 10 player in each positional ranking, except for faceoff. One guy I'm really excited to see is Mikey Drake, a guy, an Under Armour All-American guy we've really known for a while on the radar. And then Carson Cochran, an LSM that you mentioned earlier, flipped from Rutgers. Kind of fit Rutgers' play style very well because he was a very active player in the middle of the field. And here he goes going to Notre Dame, where they could probably use a player like that going forward.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think because Notre Dame plays games that tend to be a little bit lower scoring because of the efficiency of their defense, you know, they're oftentimes not looked at as being as active defensively or as active in transition as they actually are. You know, this is a team that in 2010 had Andrew Irving, who was probably leading the charge for offensive minded short, long stick midfielders. And they've had a number of guys over the course of the last six or so years that have perpetuated that in terms of their ability to bring the ball into the offensive end with the long stick. And, you know, I wouldn't say that Cochran is an offense first long stick by any stretch of the imagination, but in terms of his ability to roam and range and all that, yeah, I mean, I think that that speaks to what is probably, you know, his most substantial asset, which is his physical size. I mean, he's a monster. He's huge. And I definitely think that, you know, that is an aspect of complimenting Cohen that will go a long way, you know, if these two guys get on the field in the same time over the course of their career.
And Notre Dame's marquee goalie commit in this class is Matthew Schmidt, a goalie from Culver, Indiana. Probably one of the better, you know, performances from a goalie in the entirety of high school lacrosse last year, helping Culver to pretty much a finish as one of the marquee kind of teams across all rankings, not only in ours. You also got guys in this class like Mo Meyer, Wheaton Jackaboys, John Ryan Hallenbeck, Mike Fay, Jake Frame, who are guys who kind of fall in the middle of their class, saying these guys really athletic, don't exactly know where they might end up in Kevin Corrigan's plans just yet.
And I think that ultimately speaks to what I think is the strength of this class. You talk about the strength at the top of each position. I think it's the midfield depth. You know, there are certain positions in sports that it just helps to have depth, whatever the case is. You know, depth in starting pitching in baseball, depth in defensive line play in football. You know, having midfield depth is never a bad thing. And this group brings in somewhere between five and seven guys, between whether they're, you know, attackmen or can play midfield, vice versa, that are going to make a contribution in terms of that midfield depth. And I think that that shotgun approach is really wise, particularly for a team that heading into last season, I thought that they had somewhere between five and seven short stick D middies that they were going to be able to rely on. And for whatever reason, be it injury, be it playing offense, by the end of the season, Notre Dame was basically relying on two or three short stick D middies. You think about a guy like Nick Kashansky or Carlson Milliken. I thought Brian Costabile was going to be in that mix, and he ended up being a first line offensive middie. Drew Shantz missed time with injury. So, you know, midfield depth, so important. And particularly for Notre Dame, you know, who were at their best when they had these monsters like Nick Asallo, just able to do so many different things on the field. But ultimately, one of the things that they excelled at was requiring attention when they were barreling into the box in transition. You know, it speaks to not just the need for midfield depth, but how you utilize athleticism from the midfield in a way that wears guys down and requires depth. And that's why I think there's so much about this class from a midfield depth standpoint that is going to be really important.
And I think the wild card in this entire class is Davis Allen, a guy who was at our committed academy. Huge. We kind of thought maybe he could fit the mold of a Sergio Perkovic somewhere down the road, kind of like a big step-down shooter that could play a part for their offense going forward.
Well, and one thing about that I want to speak to is just that this team, you know, I remember in that late 2000s range, I was like, man, Notre Dame kills it in D.C., in Philadelphia, and Long Island, on Long Island. Now it feels like Notre Dame is doing a better job in the Hudson Valley than anywhere else. The number of players who flew under the radar that have gone on to excel, you know, out of at Notre Dame, I think Matt Landis, a 2-time Schmeisser Award winner, certainly is kind of at the top of that list. You know, but there are a handful of guys that have done the exact same thing. I mean, you know, Pelham High School is where Davis Allen's from. That's why I made that comment. But there are others as well that have really impressed from that region. And I think that that geographical distribution is one of the things that I find fascinating.
Terry, let's move on to our number two class that we have ranked in our recruiting issue.
Well, before we do, I want to speak to two things, Dan.
Okay,
so the first is we ranked 20 teams in this issue, and we did so on a purely objective, and I use that in quotation marks, basis. Objective based on where they were ranked, right? So we took the top 100 players, and if you were ranked between 51 and 100, you got 1 point. If you were ranked between 25 and 50, you got 2. 10 and 25, you got 3. Top 10, you got 4. And then the total score was how we sorted the top rankings. It's not necessarily the fullest way to evaluate rankings in the sense that it doesn't account for anybody in the class that wasn't ranked in the top 100, and ties are decided based on that kind of subjective opinion. So with that in mind, yes, let's move on to number two.
Yeah, it's an objective way of ranking our subjective rankings.
Exactly.
Which I like. But yeah, our number two class, which had a score of 14, was Maryland, led and headlined by our number two overall player, Bubba Fairman. You know, me and Jeff talked about him a little bit last week. You know, it kind of really came down between him and Tahoka for the number one spot. We went with Tahoka, but Bubba is a very close number two.
Well, he's so close that he's actually the co-number one attackman, and I would say he's kind of the number one swingman because, you know, and you might be about to make this point, like, I think one of the things that makes it difficult to project him number one is you don't know whether he's going to play attack or midfield.
Exactly. That's one of the things that I was going to get to. John Tillman, one of the things that he communicated to me about this class and its strengths was how many guys in it are very versatile and how many of them can play two positions. Bubba Fairman, I think me, Jeff, probably everyone in this office think that his overall potential is best suited at attack, but he could take the Colin Heacock approach and start as a midfielder just to get on the field. We'll see how things play out. Another guy who's in the same vein as that is James Avanzado, another underarm All-American for the Terps. He's a guy who, you know, considering the logjam at attack that the Terps will be facing not only this year but in the coming years, probably pans out at midfield more so than attack.
Right. Well, and I think that this is another group that has some high-end guys at each position, but ultimately it's the midfield depth that I think is one of the things that makes it comfortable to bet on a group like this. You mentioned Avanzado and Fairman, obviously, but what about Jake Martellucci, Wilson Hand, Wade Ausler? Probably the, at one point, maybe most highly thought of player out of this group would be Rowan Puglisi. And then Ryder Mora is another guy who's had some really significant contributions and some nice buzz around him as well. So just so many middies in this group that, again, in some regards, it's a shotgun-style approach, but in other regards, it's about hedging your bets. It's about saying, no, there's just a lot of guys in this group that we really like.
Yeah, that's the one overall impression of this class is it is super voluminous. I mean, you look at the size of it, it's bigger than Notre Dame's class. It's absolutely massive compared to our number three class, which is Duke. But you're right. The middies kind of are the low-key strength of this class. I'm going to start by talking about the guy you mentioned, Rowan Puglisi. From our observations on the recruiting trail, a tremendous athlete, first and foremost, has a lot of offensive skills, but I definitely see this guy panning out as a two-way player, perhaps even a wing player, because you just want that kind of physicality and that type of athleticism playing in the middle of the field and utilized efficiently at both ends.
Speed. I mean, that's really, for me, what it comes down to, you know, having an opportunity to see him play against Calvert Hall. I watched that game from the field, and I was just like, this guy moves. He knows how to move, and you can't teach it. So, for me, that's where it starts.
And the next player who is a midfielder high in our rankings is Wade Ausler, a guy that Coach Tillman said his best lacrosse is probably ahead of him. This was a guy who was a two-time MIAA selection on, quite frankly, what was a very poor Gilman team. This is a guy who, I guess, would, for all accounts, is what we would call a late bloomer, a guy who really came on late in his high school career, developed athletically and also technically, and I do think that he's going to pan out as an impactful player. Probably going to see time both ways early on, but I think down the line he'll be an offensive middie for Maryland.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I was going to ask that exact question, so I'll rephrase it this way, which is, you know, as you've seen the balance between six offensive players shake itself out at Maryland, and then over the last 2 years, as you know, certainly Heacock and Rambo, and then Maltz really solidified themselves as the top three guys. Not many offensive guys getting on the field. You know, Maryland plays the standard. I mean, the knock on John Tillman's Maryland teams at the start of his tenure was they didn't play enough guys, and that's why they ran out of gas in the championship game, because they, you know, just didn't have as deep of a bench. You know, Tillman explained that via recruiting for a while. That has since subsided. They play a lot of guys. Maryland now is in the low 20s, same as all the other teams that compete at that level in terms of their competitive games. But most of those guys are contributing not at the offensive end. You know, they tend to really kind of limit it to like 6 to 8 guys over the course of, well, maybe like 8 to 9 over the course of a typical game. So my question for you about a guy like Wade Ausler, and I'm asking specifically with the thought in mind, since you don't have Heacock and Rambo going forward, do you expect that to open up? Do you expect there to be, you know, maybe 10, 11 offensive contributors over the course of a game, you know, over the next year or two as the personnel settles itself out?
I think there'll be more potential for that next year, not technically this upcoming season, but the following season, when you've got guys like Tim Rotans and Connor Kelly leaving, and you really got to say, all right, we really do need to figure out what the future of our middle of the field looks like. What are the two midfield lines that we're going to run, and could we possibly see a third? That hasn't exactly been something that we've seen a lot of in the Tillman years. He's kind of really functioned on maybe two midfield groups of four guys in each one that he kind of likes to rotate. You know, they've kind of went through that red and gold phase in 2016. 2017, they had more of a kind of like a defined lines. But I do think that's something that's going to be more pertinent in 2019 rather than 2018.
Got it.
Moving on to our number three class, the Duke Blue Devils. After last year having the top class in the entire rankings, they have the number three class this year. A very, very small class. You know, Duke really likes to build their classes on not many spots.
But well, they get 9 spots a year.
Yeah.
So it starts there, and then, you know, if it gets fleshed out, then typically that's going to be guys who got in on their own or whatever else.
When we look at this class, we really see impact guys everywhere. It starts with Nekhai Montgomery, who for me and Jeff Shannon's money is probably the best athlete in the class. I believe he is set to play both lacrosse and football at Duke. That'll be very interesting. It's something that there is precedent with Fowler playing both positions. So it's not something that's like going to be a problem for Coach Danowski. Then we look at a guy like Rain Schamberger, who, you know, talking with people who was familiar with his game, is very highly praised, very highly touted.
Yeah, so you're right. With Montgomery, he's not going to play football. He is not playing football in 2017. So okay. That is something for later in his career if it does come to fruition. You know, my thing is, what is the best utilization of him and his speed and power? And really, it's kind of funny. I would say one of the things that's always impressed me about him is his ability to stay on his feet. You mentioned his football career. You know, he was a running back, and that's the job, right? Don't get tackled. And I've always been impressed by whether it's running through traffic in transition, digging out a ground ball, or the way you get checked when you're dodging. He just continues to move along the path that he's trying to move along. And I think that really helps as an alley dodger. You know, if you don't get knocked off your spot, it goes a long way towards being a good player. And so I think Montgomery is the type of guy who's going to be able to contribute at a high level. My question is, where does Duke need him most? Last year, depth of midfield was one of their biggest strengths. It was just a question of those guys were so young, they weren't consistent. You know, who's going to complement Brad Smith and really be a kind of go-to consistent scorer? Prendergast, Quigley, Walsh, Lindsay, you know, the number of guys who are available options is really high. One of the biggest needs is going to be replacing Griffin Van de Ven and Tommy Zanker at the short stick D midfield position. So, you know, is it, okay, this is our best and quickest way to get Montgomery on the field, or is it, no, we need it the most impactful way, which is drawing slides, you know, being that physical presence that Miles Jones represented that we haven't had since his departure. I think ultimately, it's a question that's going to get answered. And honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if the answer is different in April than it is in February, because so frequently that's the case with Duke. Who they start is not who they finish with. So, you know, I think that's kind of what we got to watch and follow with respect to this Blue Devil team.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I feel like we're going to see him on the field in February. Where he'll be in April is really what we'll be watching for in February.
The last element of the Duke recruiting class that you got to keep an eye on is Cam Bedour. You know, he tore his ACL during the high school season, and the question is, will he be available for the 2018 campaign for the Blue Devils, or will they retain a year of eligibility, redshirt him, and have him on the field for 2019? And to this point, I think that's still TBD.
Yeah, and one of the guys you haven't mentioned yet who's really kind of like a marquee recruit in this class is Joseph Stein, who I think is going to come in and possibly be their main option at faceoff, considering that they lose Kyle Rowe, who was one of the best, you know, faceoff guys in the ACC. Brian Smythe really didn't have many reps on the field last year, so he could come in and be a guy that's impactful right away. He took a PG year, so coaches love that, you know, from a physical and technical standpoint, saying, oh, this guy is basically coming in with the technical and physical maturity of a sophomore. So I'm more open to starting a sophomore than a freshman, and he's kind of in the same vein as a sophomore.
It'll be fascinating to see. I mean, you mentioned Brian Smith, and obviously he was an Under Armour All-American, really highly thought of. But, yes, that is another important question that they're going to have to answer.
And looking at the rest of their class, they've got guys like Cam Ewell, Matt Camille, Joe Robertson, and J.P. Bazile, who we don't have ranked in our top 100, but kind of fit that unassuming Duke attackman vibe I get from them, where you think that the way that Donowski sets up his offense, these guys have the skill set to thrive in it.
Cam Ulay especially is somebody that I wouldn't be surprised to see contribute quickly.
Moving on to our number 4 class, just down the road from Durham, actually tied in points, but given the 4 spot due to editorial discretion, North Carolina. And I actually really love this class. I know that it tends to get overshadowed by the 2018 class that North Carolina is bringing in, which is an absolute blockbuster class. It starts with Alex Trippi, you know, Under Armour All-American, one of the best high school lacrosse players, period, for the past 2 to 3 seasons. Me and Jeff Shannon really do think that he could come on and start right away for the Tar Heels because he kind of fits that Jimmy Bitter, Joey Sankey kind of dodging vibe that they've really lacked for the past 2 years.
I feel the same way. I think he's a special player. I think the attitude that he brings to teams is special. You know, whether it's the Badlax teams that we saw him play on or you know, his Bullis High School team, it just has something that reminds me of Marcus Holman. I agree. I think this class is a monster. I think that there's a lot of guys that are not necessarily at the top of the group that are going to make big contributions. Ryan O'Connell is another Under Armour All-American. Sean Morris is a midfielder who there's a lot of belief around what he can contribute and what he can bring to the table. A guy that I've liked over the course of the last couple of years is Ara Atayan, who I think has kind of maybe fallen off the radar a little bit relative to what the thought was surrounding him when he committed initially. So, you know, just so much power in the group, speed, athleticism, in a way that's familiar in North Carolina, maybe an overall lack of size, but at least from the offensive players, but certainly a lot of skill and a lot of potential for this group.
Yeah, Ryan O'Connell and Sean Morris, two guys who, you know, if we were to play word association, would scream to me, Alley Dodgers, and that's something I think that they missed last year with Shane Simpson not returning to the team. Defensively, this is also a pretty strong class. You got Joe Carrington, and you also got Luke Milliken, who's a guy who played at our committed academy and really impressed me and Jeff Shannon in particular. And you could say, hey, maybe if Jack Pizzula does not work out as our starter, we could go to this guy.
I like Milliken a lot, and I agree. I think he's gonna pressure Pizzula.
But overall, I think we can agree that the strength of this class, like many of the classes that we've talked about so far, is midfield depth. Just so many athletes, you know, Parker Alexander, Steven Schneider is a guy who, you know, was a captain for his Manhasset team in his senior year. Kind of just seems like a no-nonsense kind of player who always kind of sees the field at North Carolina. Kind of reminds me of Michael Tagliaferri in a way, given that he's just such a gifted physical athlete and then also just always makes the right kind of play.
Dan, now's a good time to mention that, yeah, this is such a good class that in our recruiting database, the Inside Lacrosse recruiting database, North Carolina's 2017 group is actually ranked number one. And as we begin to wind down this conversation, I want to send folks to insidelacrosse.com/recruiting with a newly launched front page that features the top class rankings over each of the subsequent four classes. So these rankings are based on the evaluation scores that are associated with each player. And so, Dan, over the course of the last couple weeks, you've been putting players' evaluation scores from the recruiting issue into the database, right? So we visit events over the course of the summer, fall, and high school season and evaluate players. In addition to that, once a year we do this kind of objective overall analysis where we rank players based primarily on the combination of our impressions as well as coaches' feedback. And so we decided that that represents its own event. And so through those evaluations, you've begun to develop a reflection of the combination of the pre-existing data plus what we're inputting based on this magazine. And there are some divergences from what we did in this 2017 top 20 versus how the rankings have shaken out on the recruiting database. But it certainly is an interesting perspective. And I think that as we continue to move forward through this process in coming years, we're going to see those two lines get a little bit closer together. So as we begin to shift the focus to the rest of the recruiting issue, Dan, what do we have in store as we move down the list podcast-wise? What are folks going to be able to look forward to over the course of the next couple weeks?
Top Young Gun seniors, the class of 2018, which, if you've kind of been following the recruiting beat, is a very highly praised class, and I will even impart this anecdote of mine. When I sat down and did the initial list, the initial top 100 list, I was like, wow, I can't believe how fast I did it because the players in the class are so talented. And two, I can't believe how many players that I wanted on this list that I left off because the players are so talented.
And so in addition to Young Gun 2018s, you'll be able to hear a podcast talking about the 2019s and 2020s. And if you check back next week, we'll be talking about the 2017 position rankings. So you got the number one conversation last week. Here we talked about the number one class, the Notre Dame Fighting Irish, and a couple of the other groups that are challenging them. If you come back next week, you're going to get a little bit more depth on the 2017s, and then in 2 weeks, the 2018s, and in 3 weeks, the 19s and beyond. So for this, I'm Terry Foy. He's Dan Ahern. We appreciate you listening. Follow us on Inside Lacrosse on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and as well as Dan_Ahern.
Yep.
And Terrence Foy. That's one R. My mom says that we spell it the Irish way. Appreciate you listening. Give us a rating and a review, and we'll be back next week.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.